Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Well, hello again and welcome. This first story I'm going to read is from the Good Old Days magazine, the April issue. And it speaks about the silent generation to which I belong. People who were born between the 30s and the 40s. Now, one psychology professor that I had at one time called it the schizo generation because we were born in between those parents of ours who were born in the 20s and were always concerned about we're going to have another depression, so we've got to hang on to our money and be careful. But yet, on the other hand, we were influenced by those in the 50s with a renewal of good times, so to speak. So we were taught, but there's so much to look forward to. So we were confused. So this story is called Children and the War Effort. He grew up waiting for life to get back to normal. And this was sent in by Ken Newser. The so-called Silent Generation, 1928 to 1945, are currently in their 80s to mid-90s. The oldest silents grew up with both the extreme economic deprivation of the Great Depression and the terrifying upheaval of World War II. Some say memory is sugar-coated. Not so for the silent generation. The hovering dark cloud of World War II dictated many aspects of our lives. The two-front war created a cosmic darkness. Living in the shipbuilding center of Manitowoc, Wisconsin, made us a likely target, though no attack ever occurred. My dad served as an air raid warden, checking his assigned area of the neighborhood to make certain blackout shades were pulled. As a passionate part of America's home front, we children feared that Hitler would, of course, make us his first target. We huddled together in darkness as sirens wailed, waiting for Dad to return. He always did. More good news. The war brought Manitowoc out of the Depression. 28 submarines were built there. Spectacular launchings for the war effort. As children, we learned to wait. We waited at home as our mothers counted tiny ration stamps to buy food and other commodities. We waited and watched Mother search for wartime cookbooks to find substitutes because of food shortages. We waited in lines at school to buy war stamps, clutching shiny dimes, hoping to fill a war bond booklet to help soldiers and the home front fight the war. That $18.75 would be worth $25 in 10 years. We waited, and we did without. Everything seemed to be rationed. Each member of the family had his or her own ration book that held tiny stamps which were torn out by the grocer when a purchase was made. This system operated under the Office of Price Administration, the OPA, ensured that each family received their fair share of rationed food, and that there would be some left for those who had not yet shopped. There were 48 blue points for canned goods and 64 red points for perishables. The ration coupon price of any given item regularly fluctuated along with the cash price. The first food to be rationed was sugar, allotting 1 pound per week per person. hoarding was out. People took care of each other and tried in various ways to help in the war effort. War cakes were made with bacon grease instead of shortening, with spices added to cover the flavor. The long list of rationed items included gasoline, chewing gum, butter, and meat. Some items could not be purchased at all, like radios, washing machines, electric irons, and toasters. If your refrigerator didn't work, you were fortunate to find an old icebox. During the war years, there were shortages of just about everything. Gasoline was strictly limited, and those who had automobiles were forced to leave them parked for all but essential travel. As young patriots on the home front, we helped collect rubber, scrap metal, tin foil from packs of cigarettes and chewing gum, and even cans of fat for the war effort. Mothers saved snippets of soap and the grease from cooking. Teachers organized newspaper and scrap drives to salvage commodities for the war effort. Get in the scrap was a way of family life. Mills could recycle waste paper quickly and at 50% of the cost of newly made paper. Industry needed razor blades, aluminum, toothpaste tubes, bottle caps, old pans, golf clubs, and car fenders to turn into planes, tanks, ships, and ammunition. Save, serve, conserve became a popular slogan. Used flashlight batteries provided zinc, brass, and copper. War factories transformed millions of old tires, rubber boots, and hot water bottles into tank treads and new tires for military vehicles. Win with tin was another popular war cry. Even animal bones were useful. Salvaged bones could supply tons of material to make glue. Manual labor was a must, even for the young. Whole families worked in their victory gardens. Small vegetable plots popped up everywhere, from backyards to parks to city rooftops. By 1943, 20 million victory gardens on a total of 4 million acres supplied a third of the nation's vegetables, answering the call to grow your own, can your own. Americans were encouraged to return to the soil and grow what food they could to supplement the meager rations we were permitted to buy. Many people went deer and squirrel hunting to put food on the table. Others went fishing. With husbands, brothers, and fathers far away fighting World War II, a generation of American women learned to become more independent than their mothers had been. The war had to be won. Female assembly line workers, a rarity before the war, were a routine wartime necessity to enable the United States to produce a sufficient volume of weapons and ammunition. Patriotic fever was high. Women, not worms, was the patriotic message. In many instances, women ran the farms. Work for victory. Three shifts covered 24 hours, running from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., followed by 4 p.m. to midnight, and then midnight to 8. Routine childhood medical problems did not take a vacation just because fathers were in the Army. Quarantine signs were placed on the front doors of homes where children had measles, chickenpox, mumps, whooping cough, and other communicable diseases. The dreaded polio virus provided the nation with yet another enemy. When Japan finally surrendered on Tuesday, August 14, 1945, a spontaneous community party erupted. From around 7 in the evening until midnight, downtown was a mass of cars blaring their horns. Pedestrians celebrated elbow to elbow on the sidewalks, and an ankle-deep debris of paper and confetti covered everything. Flags flew from car fenders. Residents rang their every bell they could find, and some even made blasts of noise with air compressors. Church services were held throughout the city that evening and during the next day. Rationing ended, except for sugar. That took a couple more years. The number of lives it cost to end the war was staggering. Several hundred thousand American soldiers and sailors lost their lives. Many children lost their fathers. Each one of the Silent Generation had family or friends whose lives were changed forever. The real impact of World War II, one person at a time, cannot be measured. And this was Children and the War Effort by Ken Newser. Boy, that story really brought back some memories. And I still have some ration books from World War II that were my mother's. Now here's another story entitled, Everyone Needs a Buddy. It didn't matter what was happening, he was always there. This was sent in by Stephanie Slayer. Yeah, I know. There are times you want to get away on your own, taking a walk, retreating to your favorite chair, pedaling around the block, or slipping away to listen to the birds, watch the sunset, or look at the stars. That's me, too, in the Coachella Valley of California, where the desert and mountains offer that solace. Even so, everybody needs a buddy sometimes. My buddy was my uncle, my mom's brother. When she was little, she couldn't pronounce his given name and nicknamed him Buddy. The name stuck with him through the four generations of humanity that Uncle Buddy graced. Was he tough? He certainly could be when the situation warranted. Was he kind? That only touches the surface. He was compassionate, helpful, gracious, and yes, although he'd never admit it, tender. Did he get people through tough times and tough situations? That was his specialty. No matter who you were, what was happening, or whether you could ever return the favor, he was there for you, finding the somehow or the some way that worked so well you could hardly believe it could turn out to be so easy. Was he up for adventures? Oh, was he. Anytime, anywhere. Running a river, riding a half-broke horse, fixing that leaky toilet, hiking the Grand Canyon, bringing home venison or fish from a hunting or fishing trip. You get the picture. He loved America and John Wayne. He could have been his double in imitating the Duke's walk and talk. He served in the military. He loved painting, and he was a superb drummer and singer, and he was never shy about exhibiting his love of all of those things. Even making family movies and videos was an adventure. There were no clumsy or shy poses and waving hands at the camera in Uncle Buddy's films. Instead, he scripted a silent Western movie in which the whole family participated, complete with a clapboard for scene changes, special effects, scenery, costumes, and bundles of laughs, even now, years past that cinematic adventure. He was self-sufficient, knowing how to hunt, fish, and trap. He saw to it that we all learned all the tricks of each trade. He never wasted or squandered anything. One of his mottos was, "Save it for the war," something we still say. He's been gracing the heavenly realms now for about a decade, but the memory of him here on earth is alive and well in things we say and do in our family. When we consider this world situation, we know he would have plenty to say and do if he were still here. So, Uncle Buddy, my buddy, I salute you and thank you for being a part of my life. God knew I needed you. And dear reader, I hope you have found, or will find, a buddy like mine. This was Everyone Needs a Buddy by Stephanie Slayer. You know, everyone is looking forward to spring, but there's one thing about spring that I fear, and that is spring cleaning. And that's what this next story is about. It's entitled Spring Cleaning. Whether it was 1933 or 1963, refreshing the house was necessary. This was written by Lynn Cassidy. Spring cleaning changed when heating houses during the winter went from wood and coal fuel to propane and gas, and later to electricity. Wood smoke and coal dust settled over everything during the winter when the house was shut up to conserve heat. Getting that residue out of the house was first on every housewife's agenda when the windows were opened in the spring. Although she later married, my great-aunt Laverne Harris was a Spencer schoolteacher in 1933 and lived with her parents on their farm near Dearborn, Missouri. Her journal for that year included many references to spring cleaning. While reminiscing with family members about spring cleaning back then, we recalled how each room was cleared and the furniture moved out. Sometimes entire rooms would be painted, or sometimes just the woodwork in that room. Windows were not just washed. The storm windows were taken down, cleaned, and put away, while screens were cleaned and took their place. Feather beds were removed to the porch. The feathers were taken from old bed ticking, and new feather beds were made. This job would have been easier if the younger brothers had been kept away. One brother did a nosedive onto the new bed before it could be sewed shut. Feathers were discovered in the oddest places all that summer. Gravel road dust, coal, and wood grime all were made short work of when it was possible to open windows and let fresh air in. As a cousin remembered, there wasn't anything not touched once spring cleaning commenced. Another cousin found out just what anything was when she helped an older lady with her spring cleaning. She was handed a toothbrush and told to clean each individual spring after the mattress was removed. There were hundreds of springs. 30 years later, my mom's spring cleaning did not include toothbrushes on the bed springs or varnishing the woodwork in every room. Heating innovations that prevented dust and grime from accumulating over the winter helped make spring cleaning a little easier. However, in 1963, Mom's spring cleaning bordered on fanatic as she prepared for her brother's wedding reception at our house in Dearborn, Missouri. Mom didn't work outside the home after I was born in 1952. Inside the home, however, there were seven of us, so she worked harder seeing to our needs than if she'd been employed. This included cleaning the house every weekend for family gatherings. But the family gathering for the wedding reception included a level of cleaning I hadn't seen in my 10 years on this earth. After her usual weekend cleaning, I knew something big was happening when Mom shined the chrome on the toaster, and then she put it away in a cabinet. We never put the toaster away. Johnson paste wax was used on every floor. Doilies were starched and could have stood up by themselves, and each flat surface in the house was cleared and polished. Linen tablecloths were ironed, and silverware was polished. Why, the five of us girls even had our patent leather shoes buffed and our can-cans ironed. This period of extreme cleaning might have been when Mom wore out her first buffer. She semi-retired a second one after she had wall-to-wall carpeting installed over those beautiful hardwood floors in the house my parents built in 1966. 11 years after Mom's spring cleaning frenzy, it was my turn to understand her vigorous scrubbing for her brother's wedding reception. In 1974, I was hosting a wedding shower picnic supper for a college friend to reciprocate for a shower she had held for me the previous year. Our small house of 2 bedrooms, living room, dining room, and kitchen was cleaned to within an inch of its life. The morning of the party, I rolled up the room-size area rug, damp mopped the hardwood floor, put down paste wax, and buffed the paste wax before dragging out the Kirby sweeper to vacuum the area rug. Only then did it go on my newly waxed living room floor. The kitchen linoleum was scrubbed before I poured no-wax liquid on it. Even before doing that, I turned the vintage chrome kitchen table upside down to scour the legs with SOS soap scouring pads. The sheer curtains took a turn in the washing machine, as did the kitchen rugs. The Kirby hose attachment scrubbed over the sofa and chairs, and the tall, waxy glass windows were polished squeaky clean. Then we cooked supper for 10 guests. I then understood why my great aunt went to bed with the chickens after spring cleaning. And this was Spring Cleaning by Lynn Cassidy, and she has included a page from her aunt's journal. It's entitled Aunt Laverne's Journal. April 1st, 1933, cleaned up the house, then got ready and went to St. Joseph. Went to food show, home about 5. April 6th, Dad found out he won a ton of coal at the food show. Now have a good start for next winter. April 14th. A good old Friday. Pretty today and most of kids outside today. Cleaned up most of the house tonight. April 29th. Stayed home today and cleaned up the house. Ironed and baked a cake. Rained nearly all day. May 22nd. Still cleaning house. Sick all day, but worked just the same. Went to bed again at 8. May 23rd. Started cleaning house this morning. Worked all day and went to bed with the chickens. May 24th. Rain today. Varnished my room. May 25th. Went over to Eileen's today and washed all our bedclothes in her newfangled washing machine. Rained, and of course they didn't get dry. Came home about 2 and finished cleaning the upstairs, in bed early. May 26th. Went to St. Joseph today. Kurt, her younger brother, had to have his suit remodeled. Home at 4 and then cleaned the front room. Finished at 7 o'clock. In bed by 8:30. May 29th. Started cleaning house again. We'll finish this week. May 30th. Still cleaning house, not much else doing. May 31st, varnished hall and dining room and washed the kitchen. Sure all in when I finished. In bed early. Wow, that's a lot of cleaning. Now, here's an item in the Bits and Pieces section of the Good Old Days magazine. And this is entitled Sack Dress, sent in by David Alden. In 1957, my girlfriend, Marie, while paying her way through nursing school, wished she could afford a sack dress, which was fashionable during that time period. I asked her if I made one, would she wear it? When Marie said, sure, I don't think she knew what she was literally getting into. Walter, a co-worker of mine, who also had a dairy farm, fulfilled my request for an empty burlap feed bag. After cleaning the bag, I cut a V opening at the top for Marie's head to pass through. Next, I took the V piece I'd cut out, cut it in half, which gave me two pieces, one for each sleeve. Not knowing how to sew, I wired them on. The sack was carefully selected for the most realistic wording. It was printed with lettering like full of pep, sweet 20, which Marie was at that time, and 100 pounds. Well, now we've been married over 63 years, with 4 daughters, 10 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren, and Marie is still full of pep. This was Sack Dress by David Alden. And one more brief item entitled Memories of a Special Birthday by Marilyn Beam. The most memorable and happiest birthday I remember was my 7th birthday in April 1948. I wanted a bicycle so badly that I rode my tricycle around balanced on 2 wheels. Money was very tight as we had just moved from Oregon back to Ohio and into our very first owned little house. Dad told me he wished he could buy me a bike for my birthday, but he just couldn't afford it. Maybe next year. I was disappointed, but I understood. Little did I know, Dad and Mom had been saving for a bike for me. They bought me a new 24-inch blue Schwinn, which was well hidden in the garage. What a surprise. And that concludes today's broadcast. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.